guest this morning is Liz Hicks, who describes herself as a middle-aged mad woman who goes to countries nobody else wants to go to. So immediately the four W's come to mind. What, when, where, and why?
Right.
So I've read your CV, and you have a long history in the voluntary sector, but let's talk about VSA, Volunteer Service Abroad. What brought you into that?
What brought me into that was I had the opportunity to do some self-funded volunteering with a palliative care doctor in South India. And I came back from that and was talking with my friend who was the recruitment person for VSA. She said, "I've got just the job for you, Liz." And that was actually in Zimbabwe, working in an orphanage for children with AIDS. And unfortunately, before that could proceed, Mugabe got more obnoxious than usual, and they stopped that program. But she said, no, don't lose heart. I have something for you in Timor-Leste. And so that was the start of it, really. I applied and was accepted and approved and psychologically tested and became a management advisor at the Biopeter Clinic in Timor-Leste.
Was this during the times of their troubles?
It was, which was unfortunate, really, because it led to a level of dissatisfaction, really, because you go there, you start, you develop the relationships, you listen to what they want you to do, you start to sort of work with the people there to implement that. And then, unfortunately, the civil rest got so unruly that VSA, and rightly so, removed their volunteers from Timor for a time. Then, after a couple of months, they let two of us back into the country. And unfortunately, then 3 months later, they pulled us again. So that's very unsatisfactory, A, because you're not completing the task you thought you were going to do, but also you suddenly become aware that as a white person, foreign, with a big organisation behind you, you are plucked out of a dangerous situation, leaving it behind colleagues to deal with it.
So how do the people that you're talking with and working with, how do they react to a middle-aged white mad woman coming and telling them what to do?
First of all, you don't tell them what to do if you're going to be successful, I think. I have seen examples of other agencies who do go in and tell people what to do. But VSA's approach has always been we only work with organisations that have asked us to do a particular task for them. And a really good example of that is actually in Timor-Leste, where this was a collective of women under the name Hafoti. And after when VSA restarted the program in Timor, I went back as a paid staff member to set up an office and restart that volunteer program. And I was talking to them one day and just finding out what they wanted, how it would work, blah, blah, blah. At the end of it, I said, "Now, this is what I think you're telling me you need." But I was also aware from watching the women that there was something else going on. And I said, "But I also think there's something you're not telling me." And they sort of looked at each other and I said, "Come on, you have to tell me. Because it's not going to work for you if we don't get it right." So they said, "Well, we did have a volunteer from somewhere else, and she came in and she said, 'This is what you're doing wrong, and this is what you must do. You won't get us a volunteer like that, will you, Liz?'" And I said, "Well, that's not the VSA approach. So no, we will try very hard not to get you one of those." Now, the end result of that is that that group of women as a collective have had seven different VSA volunteers over a period of about 10 to 15 years. And those women are now marketing and selling some of their produce in Australia. So I think that's a fabulous example of how it can work well.
So what do you actually do with them? And is it only women you ever work with?
No, not really. Certainly in Timor it was a health clinic, so there were men and women there. In Bougainville, which followed on, was primarily with women because it was on a domestic violence safe houses scheme. Right. So,
in Bougainville, was that the time of the uprisings there as well?
No, that was post the conflict. There's always little niggly sort of internal say, incidents occurring. But no, generally the country was pretty stable. And it was by then it was 10, 15 years on from the finishing of the Civil War there. So
how long were you both in East Timor and in Bougainville?
In East Timor, it was a 6-month stint, and then 2 months out, and then 3 months in, and then out again. And then I went back for about 18 months as the paid manager to reset the volunteer
program. Always in their capital cities or working out in the community?
In East Timor, it was in Dili, in the capital city, which was an interesting experience because you had large groups of the UN still there doing their sort of post-conflict end development work. But in Bougainville, no, definitely out in the jungle, you know.
So what exactly was your role there? What were you trying to achieve with them?
Okay. My background generally in the NGO sector in New Zealand has been operational management.
What does that mean?
I suppose making sure organisations, systems, processes work well. So in the health clinic, it was just looking at the way the management was going of the clinic itself. An example of something that they discovered and needed to address was the finance manager was a young woman. She really wanted to be an engineer, but life hadn't quite put that in place for her, so she was working as the finance person. And she was running a loan scheme on the side with the clinic's money for all good purposes. But what she didn't understand, because she didn't have a financial background, was that if you have loaned a bit of money in advanced wages to the point of something like $900, and that person only earns $128 a month, they're never going to pay that money off. And the loans were about cultural things. If grandma died, this person, family member, was seen to be working in a paid job so they could buy the buffalo to celebrate grandma. So it was attention, and she was not making money out of it. She just thought she was doing the right thing for the staff. So it's about sitting down and explaining that this is how it's, you know, and how can we start to address that and get some of the money paid back.
So any follow-up, any follow-on from all your time there, do you go back and check?
I did go back to Timor. I've been back both places. I did go back to Timor. That was after I'd been sort of started resetting a new program there. And I just wanted to go back and see, because you talk to these people, you develop an assignment, it comes back to Wellington, VSA, select a volunteer to go. But you never quite know whether it's working or whether the organisations that you talked with are happy. So I did go back, yeah.
And the programs continue? Mostly.
Yeah. To be fair and realistic, they don't always. They don't always work out. In Timor, I had a pair of volunteers and selected with all good processes, but like any HR process, because that's really what it is, you don't always get it right. And the organisation that they are working with has the right to say, this is not working, please remove the volunteer, which is a really hard one to do.
Yes.
from all points, but it's very clear from VSA that the organisation they're working with is in charge of what they get and what happens.
So your role was administrative, organisation, and setting up systems to enable volunteers to continue their work in the community. Is that what it was about?
No, it was not quite. It was more about, like in Bougainville, for example, I worked with a group of nuns, which was an interesting experience, not even being a Catholic. And they were running 4 safe houses for women and children. So that was looking at the management, how they were managing it, how they were keeping records so that they could then apply for international funding to support the project. And it was also about introducing the concept of policy, which sounds horrific and you think, oh no, please, not policy all over the place. But that was just very simple policy. And I went with the nun, Sister Lorraine, who who is a fantastic visionary, recognised worldwide now, and said, I think if we had five simple policies that we just focused on and kept implementing and kept emphasising and made happen, the women and children would be safer. They were simple things like there will be no men in the safe house at any time. But you need to have an exception to that and you need to understand why. Because in Bougainville, if the drains get blocked, there are no female plumbers in Bougainville. So it's about a simple policy that will be effective in a simple way of implementing it.
And these women presumably had children as well with them.
Yeah.
So there was them to care for as well. Mm.
But then I could tell a funny story. So you put this policy in place. And I just happened to be at one of the safe houses unexpectedly. So I just thought, I'll pop in and say hello. Went in, there's two young women. There's no fences on the safe house. Two young women sitting in the sun with their babies. And I said, oh, hi, I'm Liz from VSA. And other nuns, you know, other nuns around. It happened to be a Sunday. And they said, oh, no, they've all gone to church. They've gone to mass. I went, okay, so we have a policy, you know, that one of our policies was that there will always be a nun or a staff member on site at all times. So I thought, okay, anyway. 20 minutes later, we're chatting and round the corner come three nuns. And I said, oh, Liz, very excited to see me. That's great. I said, just asking a question about the policy we've got on the wall there. That, you know, why didn't one of you stay behind to meet that policy? Oh, well, we asked the clients if they wanted to go to mass and they said they didn't, so we went. So at that point, I whipped into their constitution, which says their main purpose is to keep women and children safe and work with the poor and the needy, and point out that I've not been religious myself, but I did feel that God would forgive them if one of them stayed for a mass once a week to actually do the work that their order says they're there to do.
How did you get on with the Mother Superior? My experience of Mother Superiors has never been good.
It's an interesting order. It was started by a Marist sister, French Marist sister, and is specifically for Melanesian women. So they don't actually have a Mother Superior. It's not, there's no career path.
There's no hierarchy.
No, there's a sort of hierarchy, but there's no clear path that you can come in as into the novitiate and end up being the Mother Superior through an automatic process. They actually elect the leader, that she's just called the leader of the order, every 4 years. And it's quite a political election process.
How were they funded?
Through the Catholic Church. The actual order itself is funded through the church and through the families of the nuns will make donations, and all the nuns are expected to do different levels of fundraising themselves because their stipend from the order is quite small, so they're often fundraising to provide for their little extra necessities in life. And then the way they organise themselves, they do the religious sort of social services work at a kind of pastoral level, but then they get approved projects. So I was working on the domestic violence program, which included the safe houses. So that was a mandated program of the order. So in that case, they could apply for international funding, and New Zealand Aid and Australia Aid funded that program, aspects of that program directly.
Did you manage to live a life outside in the community, observe what was going on and the violence, and were you ever afraid, or were you completely secure in your little
bubble.
Circle
bubble? I think in both countries, I've never actually felt afraid, even in Timor. When the civil crisis was going on in 2006. First of all, because VSA has a policy that you live in community. So I lived in a house with no bars in the window. It was house divided, a local house divided in two. My landlady lived in one half with her family. I lived in the other half. They were very careful that I was kept safe. even when there was gunfire in the street, burning of houses, they just quietly come and say, Liz, we think you should come and sit with us and have a cup of tea for a couple of hours. And after a couple of hours, I'd get bored and say, I think I could go home. I never stayed awake at night worrying. I slept. The only time I didn't sleep was the night before I got evacuated because it was just an emotional turmoil. And the first night back after the evacuation, when there were new noises in the sky, and until I've worked out what the noises are, I don't sleep, so no. But you have to be sensible.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You don't look for trouble. You know, taking the staff from the clinic home at the end of the day in my truck, because I was lucky enough to have a truck.
You had a truck?
I had a truck, a VSA truck, a very old Toyota Hilux that I was very fond of, except when it needed to have a tyre change. But I put a local person in the front seat with me who could direct me, and if we drove down a street where there was looking like something going on at the end of the street, he or she would be able to say, turn left here, turn right here, Liz, and we can still get that staff member home. I had the truck clearly identified as having a New Zealand content in it.
Yeah.
And that's because New Zealanders are very, very well respected, both in Bougainville and in Timor-Leste. They're recognised as...
Because of VSA or for other reasons?
I think the police have been there and the Defence Force have been in both countries. And they have another, like VSA, the reputation of going into a community and asking. Going into a community saying, is there a house here we can rent to put our team in? Or they go in with a soccer ball and start kicking it around.
Do you go in with a determined period of time or do you go in open?
No, the VSA assignments when you, they range. Some are as short as 3 months. Some 6 months. The long-term ones are considered to be 2 years, and then you can have an extension. I ended up basically in Bougainville for 3.5 years.
Because it's a long way to be away from home.
You do get breaks, so that's good, and you look forward to those. They give you an amount of money. It's not necessarily enough to get back to New Zealand, but there's a requirement, and I think that's fair with most international aid organisations, that you need a break away from it, where you just recharge your batteries. And so somewhere like Darwin or Bali beckons from Dili, or not sure Port Moresby is a place for recreation, but...
Oh, really?
No.
They have the rascals over there.
They do. They do.
Did you have rascals in Timor or...?
You had some naughty boys. There'd be naughty village boys who did naughty things. It's not quite the same. I found Bougainville interesting because it's really part of the Solomon Islands. I mean, they call... Bougainvillians call Papua New Guineans redskins because they said they don't even know how to be black, Liz. You know? and that's a historical thing from the 19th century when lines were drawn in Europe as to where countries on the other side of the world needed to be.
Would they need to be civilised?
Partly, yes.
Which is presumably why the nuns are there. Original nuns would have come from afar.
The original one that started the order certainly did, and there have been waves. There was a wave of American ones came in and taught very good cooking skills and dressmaking skills. But now all of the nuns in the order are Melanesian. And you could. They did offer me a fast-track option at one point if I wanted to become a nun, but I said thank you, but no thank you.
Tell me about just everyday living there.
Everyday living.
Because it would be hot.
It's hot.
And bothersome and sweaty. It's hot. And there are snakes and fleas and gnats and all that kind of things.
I found it's lovely. You organise yourself. The generator would give you electric power for 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours in the evening, 6 till 9 if you were lucky. The generator went on. So you had to make sure you charged your laptop and anything else that needed charging then. There was no very limited internet. When I first went to Bougainville, I had literally at some point climbed a tree to use my cell phone. And so limited access to emails and messages back home.
How could you get help in an emergency then?
I was 40 minutes from... 40 to 50 minutes away from the main town. VSA covers medical evacuations and services. There is a hospital there. and two other volunteers came and worked with me at Chabai and from VSA, and we did have a situation where one of them was really sick very quickly, and it was just put in truck, drive to the hospital, and he was successfully treated there. But VSA was informed and they had the medical evacuation on standby, if you can. And I was evacuated from Bougainville for a tooth problem to Cairns. So it's you've got the backup there.
So VSA presumably gives you a job, a house. What about food? How do you go about shopping? What do you... do you get your necessities?
Well, I loved it there because for breakfast you'd have the most amazing pawpaw, pineapple, 27 varieties of banana,
really?
avocados, just sitting there waiting for you to
and
enjoy.
And not $10 for smashed avocado on toast.
No. And passion fruit. I discovered passion fruit more recently. And you can go into town. You go into town, maybe once a fortnight, and stock up on the basics like the flour and the and
would
the
you
sugar.
Eat meat there? Is meat safe there?
Yeah, very little meat. You can get it in the supermarkets at a price, so I didn't bother because there's plenty of fish. And we'd usually do a deal because I was in the community at Chabai, which is like a village community, just happened to be a lot of nuns walking around in it as well as local people. The local fishermen would come in with a fresh tuna, quite large, and I was the only one who ever had any cash on hand. So I would buy the tuna for the community and say, can you please cut me a steak, because I like to cook it fresh. They cook it differently. So they'd come back to me with a steak for night, and then the rest of it would be distributed as they saw fit around the village and the clients and the safe houses, whatever. So food-wise, I thought it was fantastic. Everything's organic. There's the most amazing greens to eat. There's fresh garlic and fresh ginger. The ginger is just delicious because it's soft and juicy. And
not like the stringy ginger we get here.
No,
in the
it's just beautiful. And you go to the market. There were a couple of local markets, and usually the word would go out, the truck's going to the market, do you want anything or do you want to come? So beautiful food.
Would you go back?
No, I think I've done. I did go back after the 3.5 year stint. I went back and personally funded a stint to work with Sister Lorraine on some other work that she was doing, which was not really VSA related, and she wasn't getting a volunteer to do it. I went back and did 3 months with her, and then I've had 2 3-month stints back working with the head of the order, just looking at their financial management. But that's it. No, my life has moved on and changed. I'm 75, so I think I have other things to do and grandchildren and things like that. So,
well, that is a very brave and fascinating life. So thank you for coming in. Have you got a piece of music that suits the conversation that we've had about your life in Bougainville and East Timor?
I think I have. I've got a song which I think shows that sort of development approach, the mercenary missionaries approach, from a guy called Ian Campbell, who's an Australian who's been very involved in the peace movement around that area. And
the name of the song? Blue Guitar or something?
Oh, yes, Blue Guitar. Sorry.
Thank you very much, Liz. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And I don't think I want to go and visit these countries in spite of the fascination that you inspired.
So perhaps I am a mad woman after all.
Thank you very much.
Well, there is no law and order in Honiara now. My longer up at Rover says the ship has gone down. But the walkers in the corner ain't here for playing cards. They say, boy, be all right. Just play your blue guitar. So I picked my blue guitar and I started playing slow. Had another heavy night again last night, you know. I was up till 7:30 at the Tropicana bar, playing Baby I Go to Rio on my lucky blue guitar. small Pacific towns start to look the same. Missionaries, mercenaries playing their little games. Better bash him with the Bible than the butt of an SLR. So they say, but either way, I'd rather play my blue guitar. SIPL plantations yesterday went up in flames. See, the mining boys are asking if the candle's worth the game. Well, the captain of the yacht club lights his last cigar and says the only thing still working here is a fucking blue guitar. Some old expat from the bar said, boy, your guitar is not blue. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? Who the hell are you? I hit a six off Dennis Lilly and I clean bald Gavaskar. This is the 27th century. This is a blue guitar. My friend the bar girl Annalisa, she is uglier than sin. She got an ass as big and wide as a yellow wheelie bin. Her husband Clive is 6'5", well he's only 7 stone. They say you ought to hear the racket when she's jumping on his bones. Oh, you could hear them singing to each other in the room next door to mine. Got a little dog called Samson with 7,000 fleas. The French anthropologist said, bon flea collar. I said, mercy on your soul, man. She said, merci, au revoir. J'ai une autre chanson bleue, c'est pas chanson, c'est blue guitar. From the big fight, hear the echoes of the 8-inch guns a pound. Sending sailors to the bottom of the iron bottom sound of an evening. See their spirits crawling up from the sandbar. They like to come ashore some nights to hear my blue guitar. I'm going back to my homeland. I do believe it's time. Gonna work for Ashton Circus, toe the fucking line. Get my shit together just to watch it fall apart. My boots are made of leather and there's sorrow in my heart. My boots are made of leather and I cannot play the part. My boots are made of leather and I got this blue guitar.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.